Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Every armchair quarterback has dreamed of suiting up with his or her favorite team, but most of us mere mortals have a better shot at winning the lottery. But my guest today did some reasoning. He wasn't completely out of shape. He had the time and the discipline to perfect his field goal kicking, and as a sports writer, he had plenty of great contacts throughout the NFL. Plus, he really, really wanted to write about the league from an insider's point of view. So why couldn't he tag along with the pros preparing for the 2006 season? Sure enough, he got his wish. Author Stefan Fatsis has covered sports for the Wall Street Journal, and he is a frequent contributor to NPR's All Things Considered. His new book about the experience is called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. Stefan, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris. It's great to be here.
The biggest shock to me in all this, honestly, is how stressful life is for these guys. We sort of assume that they walk around just enjoying their God-given athletic talents, but they're pretty much treated as disposable commodities.
They are disposable commodities, and more so in the National Football League than in our other sports, because there are no guarantees in football. There are no guaranteed contracts. So when you read about a member of the Cowboys signing some multi-billion dollar deal, you have to think about what a player said to me, which was when I talked about, he was talking about the pain and suffering of football, and I said, yeah, but they'll give you $500,000 in exchange for it. And he said, not next year. There are no guarantees in football, and that does contribute mightily to how players treat their jobs.
And in fact, if they're out for a certain amount of time because they've been injured, they also don't get paid.
Once you make it onto the roster, you're guaranteed your salary for that season. But if you get injured, during training camp right now, if a guy goes down, he will not get the contract, the money that he was promised in the contract that he signed. In fact, in the next couple of weeks, teams will be strategically cutting veteran players to avoid having to pay them their full salaries for the season in case they should get injured in the last week of the preseason games.
And then even once the season begins, and we see this in the book, these guys can almost never relax in terms of job security.
No, it's like one player said to me, it was a fullback named Kyle Johnson, a really thoughtful guy who really opens up to me in this book and became a good friend of mine during training camp. And Kyle said, you know, it's not like they're any easier on you in week 20 than they are in week 1. Nothing changes. It's the players are the most disposable part of this equation in football. And that's not to say that we should feel sorry for them, because players are like any of us. They make choices about what to do with their lives. But I found the experience to be incredibly enlightening, because we have so many assumptions about what athletes are like and what pro sports are like. And part of my goal in writing this book was to help demystify it.
Let's talk about the pecking order in the NFL, and specifically, I guess, in a really top-down organization like the Broncos. Can you talk about how power is wielded there and by whom?
Well, in Denver, power is wielded largely by Mike Shanahan, who's the head coach, and he's also has a loftier title, vice president of football operations or something like that. But essentially, every decision that involves the team is made by Mike, in consultation often with the owner if it's a major decision, and sometimes in consultation with his underlings, though often it's really Mike's decision and the job of the people below him or to the side of him, like the general manager, who it was a guy named Ted Sundquist when I was there, and he ends up getting fired after the season, this past season, actually. So Mike wields the power, and everything sort of comes from the top down. And the benefits of that are that you know who's responsible for running this business. The downside is for everybody below Mike and the culture of sort of insecurity that gets created in the NFL. The assistant coaches are worried about their jobs, and they pass that insecurity on to the players, who are worried about their own jobs. So you get this pervasive atmosphere of paranoia and insecurity that really does, it pervades the organization.
Now, the management was able to recognize that stress was a factor, at least to the extent that the Denver Broncos thought this was a good idea, a good reason for taking you on, that you would be sort of a source of fun during the training part of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. And I credit Mike Shanahan and Pat Bowlen, the team owner, for recognizing that, you know, the media don't have to be the enemy or not even the enemy, worse in a way, something that you treat benignly, sort of just as part of your job description. And that's really how most NFL coaches and front offices treat reporters, and with good reason. It's something on their to-do list. They're required to talk to reporters a certain amount of time. And in Mike Shanahan's world, you know, he gives the reporters what he wants to give them, And the reporters tend not to get much more. He is in control of that side of the game, too. So in making this decision to let an outsider in, a writer in, the Broncos were fully aware that our business is open to scrutiny, and we're willing to subject ourselves to that scrutiny. And from the coach's perspective, I do believe it was, yes, over the course of these grueling, boring, stultifying summers, I think the Cowboys are in Denver right now, practicing for a couple days before they play a preseason game this coming weekend, a little levity wouldn't hurt. A break from the sober, serious approach that we've all got toward the NFL.
Stefan Fatsis is my guest. He's an author and a sports commentator that you frequently hear on All Things Considered. His new book is called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. Now, we should say, Stefan, that 172, I guess, was your all-time high weight, and you worked really hard to get up to that.
Excuse me. Yes, I did. It took me about a year of working with a personal trainer and a kicking coach to grow from about 160, which was definitely not an acceptable NFL weight, to get up to about 172. And I took this seriously. And, I make the comparison in the book with George Plimpton and his book Paper Lion from the early 1960s. And the difference I felt was that I wanted to really understand what an athlete goes through to prepare, and that meant trying to get into shape. Because I also knew that in the modern world, and players would treat me with greater respect and were more likely to trust me and open up to me and accept me as a member of the team for a few weeks if I demonstrated at least that I was competent and that I was trying and that I was taking my job as seriously as they take their job. So, yeah, I spent a year and lifted a lot of weights and managed to get up to 172. And at one point in camp, I wasn't even the lightest player on the team.
All of a sudden, so you hire this kicking coach, and you had to learn how to make the same motion every single time that you were trying to kick the football through the field goal, which I think for people who haven't tried this would sound like, after a while, not such a hard thing to do.
Well, it is one of the most difficult things that I've ever attempted in my life. It's like a golf swing, and if you're going to be Tiger Woods, you have to be obsessive about how you approach your craft. And the best athletes and the best kickers, too, are people that have been doing this thousands and thousands and thousands of times. They've repeated these motions over the course of their lives since they were teenagers or younger in some cases. I had a few months to learn how to become a kicker, and I was able to learn the basic motions, and I'm not a terrible athlete, and I'd played soccer for much of my life, so I could kick a ball fairly well. But this was unlike anything I had ever attempted. Just the discipline that's required to repeat this action to the point where you can have it, you can summon it on command, is pretty amazing. And that's why, watching the Olympics, I have this respect for what these athletes go through and how they become so great at their crafts. And the same applies to the NFL.
You even had to learn a different way to tie your shoes.
I did. I had to tie them off to the right on my kicking shoe so that the knot doesn't get in the way of the ball and affect the trajectory at all.
We should pause here to point out that once you were allowed to train with the team and that you knew that you'd be there, you investigated that other sort of longstanding cliche of professional athletes, a sneaker deal. How did that work out?
It worked out well. I have a slight advantage in that I'd been a sports business reporter for more than a decade, so I had a few contacts. Well, when I called up Reebok, the guy who was responsible for the Broncos was, in fact, a former Broncos equipment manager, and he wanted to play along right away. He said, look, you're going to be on the roster. You're going to be on the team. I want to treat you like I would treat a rookie coming into the NFL. And so he sent me a contract. I didn't sign it because I didn't think it would be, journalistically ethical to take the $3,000 worth of free merchandise that I was promised. But he sent me shoes, which I gladly accepted. And one day I got to Broncos training camp for the start of the second mini camp, and this was in early July. And there were five boxes from Reebok in my locker with my number on the side of them. And the players all sort of did a double take and were like, "What? How did you get these?"
What was your number?
My number was 9.
And any special reason for that?
I had a choice, 8 or 9, and that was it. Every other number was taken, and 7 is retired by the Broncos for John Elway, and kickers aren't, taking number 93. So that was I had to make a split decision in the trainer's room 15 minutes after I had arrived at that training camp, 8 or 9, and I went with 9.
Have they now retired 9?
You know, I went back to camp last week, and a wide receiver was wearing it, and I was very, very disappointed.
You also got to, at one point, there was a, you know, the sick kid that gets the ball sort of signed for him, and you got to be part of signing that ball.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the offensive linemen handed me the ball that morning and said, "Hey, you want to sign this?" And I sort of laughed, like, "Oh, come on, I'm not really on the team." And he said, "No, no, you got a number, man, sign." And I asked him, "Well, who's it for?" And I thought it was just for a friend or something. And he said, "No, it's for a sick kid in the hospital." And that kind of shut me up. It was like, wow, we make fun of these cliches, but hey, here are these guys in the NFL locker room who take it seriously. And when someone asks them to do something that reflects that they have this value in society that maybe is excessive when we consider what other people do for a living, but at least when they're given these opportunities, they take advantage of them. So I eagerly signed my name on the ball and handed it back to them.
I know, Stefan, that having covered sports for a long time, you don't labor under the misconception that all athletes are not very bright or that they don't have any responsibility. But having prepared yourself physically for this experience, I'm wondering if you really had thought enough about how to prepare yourself mentally for what you're about to undertake.
I don't think I did, though many people talk to me about it, including my kicking coach, including a sports psychologist that I consulted, a guy that is the psychologist for the Baltimore Ravens near where I live in Washington. But nothing really prepares you for when you get there. I mean, I was sort of dropped into this completely alien environment, and I describe it in the book as, you know, when the equipment manager leaves me at my locker on that very first morning, I describe it like the last plane leaving the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in 1975. I felt completely alone. And so until you're dropped in and abandoned in that sort of world and forced to function, you don't really know how to respond. And that was just the social part, explaining myself, having these 6'4", 300-pound guys sort of stare down and laugh at me, at this little gray-haired guy who was suddenly in their midst, and explaining what I was doing there. And that was easy. You know, I can take this humiliation. I could deal with the initiation rites. But the actual physical part on the field, the kicking part, when you're asked to, you know, when you're dressed like everybody else and you're asked to perform a job like other people there, and you recognize just how unprepared and incompetent you're going to be, it's a difficult thing to wrap your brain around, and it was difficult for me.
And people may not give this much thought, but these days training camps are public events. There are journalists all over the place. There are members of the public. So it wasn't like you were doing this sort of in the privacy of some practice field.
No, initially I was. At mini camp, those are these three-day short camps in the spring and early summer. There's no fans there. But then when training camp starts, and the fans in Dallas are very aware of this, there are going to be several thousand people there on some days. Some camps draw as many as 5,000 or 10,000 people. The Broncos typically attracted between 1,000 and 2,000 fans every day, who were coming out to watch these players sort of run routes and drills and rarely tackle, and sort of you have no real context for what they're doing unless you're part of the team and you know what the drills signify. But yet they are there every day. And so the first time I was summoned to kick, the reality of all those fans dawned on me. Like, wow, I am performing, and this is my performance because I'm probably not going to get to kick in an actual NFL game.
And we will find out what happened when you took that kick in just a moment. Stefan Fatsis is here. He's an author and a sports commentator that you've heard on All Things Considered. His new book is called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. We'll take your calls in just a moment. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Stefan Fatsis. His new book is called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. So, Stefan, you're called upon to make this kick, and there are fans assembled and media assembled and different people. And we should point out that not only were the fans really not aware that you were any different from anyone else on the team, by this point, you had started to feel like everybody else. You didn't think to yourself, well, I'm just a journalist and this is just a story. You really wanted to get it right.
I did want to get it right. I think any time you become part of an alternate universe, you want to fit in. I mean, journalistically, it was easier and more effective if I could fit in because I knew that the team would trust me. But a lot of that happened organically. I felt more and more comfortable being around. I was less self-conscious about the fact that I was 5'8" and small and gray-haired. And the players were comfortable with my presence. I quickly became friends with these guys. I mean, there is a sort of Stockholm syndrome involved in NFL training camps. You bond with the people that are around you. It's a cliche when we talk about sports and the locker room, but just physically, when you're around the same people for 14 hours a day, you get to know them and you get to feel close to them. So I did a little bit start to forget. I mean, every time I would drift into the, hey, I'm better than I think I am, I would shank a 35-yard field goal, you know, and send some bunny rabbits scurrying on the practice field. But more often than not, I was doing well. I was making 30 and 35 and 40-yarders. I had no illusions that I was going to play in the NFL for real, make the team. But I did want to do well, and I expected to do well, because I think if you have the mindset of an athlete once, you've always got the mindset of an athlete. You want to compete, and you want to win, and you want to do well.
And when you were feeling bad about yourself, you sort of got your mojo back in a way that is probably unusual in the NFL. You would challenge the other players to a game of Scrabble.
It's true. And I did this after my first disastrous attempt at kicking field goals in front of the fans and in front of the team. It was more pressure than I'd ever felt in my life. And I truly did choke. And the players, after they were done making fun of me, empathized, and they said to me, you know, now you get it. Now you're one of us. Now you understand what it feels like to actually face the pressure of performance and be lucky that all you had riding on this was 30 minutes off of meetings, which were the stakes that head coach Mike Shanahan said if I had made this 30-yard field goal instead of your job. But once I got over the first sort of 20 minutes and made my humbling walk through the locker room, I realized the players had a lot more in their minds. And my recovery steps included understanding that, hey, these guys are worried about their own jobs. And my little 15 minutes of fun here, or 15 minutes of total humiliation, are just that, 15 minutes. And they have to move on and deal with their injuries and their thoughts and their emotions and their fears and just get into the next practice. But for me, I did have this fallback, which was Scrabble. And as it turned out, when I got to training camp, much to my surprise, the guy in the next locker to me, he was a 6'5", 290-pound tight end named Chad Mustard. Chad looked at me and he said, dude, I know who you are. You wrote that Scrabble book. I play Scrabble all the time. It turns out he plays online and with his family, and he insisted that I bring in a Scrabble board to training camp. And so I kept a board and tiles and a official Scrabble player's dictionary in the locker room and in my locker, and we would go play Scrabble. And that very day when I missed those kicks, after lunch, and there's about 2 or 3 hours until the next practice and the players have some downtime, and I went and played Scrabble with Chad and sort of asserted my competence in something else.
So they all felt like suddenly you understood what it was like to be under this kind of pressure. And you know, there are a lot of fans and a lot of sports writers that will really be very derisive of a player that has missed something that seemed to have been an easy shot or an easy goal. And I'm wondering how quickly the players forgive each other when something has gone horribly wrong.
Well, when it goes horribly wrong, if you're on the team during the season, I think it's like any other world. You're not going to say anything to one's face. There was sort of a taboo in the locker room, I discovered, about discussing other people's abilities. And this is particularly acute during training camp when so many jobs are on the line. When I was there, there were more than 90 players filtered through the Broncos training camp that summer. Today, because of some rule changes in the NFL, they're down to about 80 players. But only 53 will make the final roster, and then another 8 will make the practice squad. And on the practice squad, you only make about a third of what the minimum salary is in the league. So players are acute of how they're performing, and they're far more realistic than I expected. They know if they're doing well or not. They all watch the same film. They all know what to look for. They are acutely aware of where they stand, even if the coaches don't clue them in. So, and this is a problem. This is sort of where the insidious paranoia creeps in. You think that you're doing poorly, and you watch it on the film, and you know something is wrong. But until someone validates it, until the coach says, "Stefan, you're screwing up. You're on the bubble. You may not make the team," you're not quite sure where you fit. And players don't get a lot of feedback in the NFL. Coaches aren't patting them on the head and calling them into their office for a heart-to-heart where they talk about the steps they can take to improve. I mean, it's much more deterministic. You watch the film, and if you're not doing well, you get yelled at or you get told what to do, but you're never explicitly warned, you're never explicitly told exactly where you stand.
That seems surprising, and so does the fact that NFL players, who most people think of as privileged, despite the hardships that they go through, spend a lot of time kvetching about work.
They did, to me anyway. They don't kvetch a whole lot in the locker room. There's certain off topics. I mean, everyone complains about whether practice is too hard or whether they're tired or what injuries are bothering them. But the sort of the deeper emotional stuff, I think they save for their family and their close friends or their teammates when they're not at the facility, not in the locker room or on the field. And with me, I don't know. I think it was partly a catharsis for some players. It was a way to get it off their chest. I can finally tell someone who's not a football player per se, who's not a family member because they don't understand. I can tell someone who seems to get it what it really feels like for me and what the pressure points are. So I would have these heart-to-hearts with these guys. We'd go into an empty meeting room between practices. I'd turn on my tape recorder, and they would talk about what they were going through. And this, to me, was fascinating because players don't talk like this to the daily media, and it really took having someone there who was willing to subject himself to the daily rigors and even just being there every day, as I said, in order to make them feel comfortable enough to talk about their genuine emotions about playing this brutal sport.
The Broncos do have a team psychologist. What is her role exactly?
Every team in the NFL has one these days and have had them for years. The woman at the Broncos had been in the NFL for about 25 years. And her role, as I discovered, runs the gamut from doing real valuable player assistance work, players who are having emotional difficulties, who may be experiencing depression, who are fearful for their jobs, have never been in this kind of an environment before. And players go very quietly to the psychologist. This is, again, not something that's broadcast. There was one player, one of my teammates, did keep her number on a Post-it note in his locker and told me that he did go see her because he needed to, because he was so troubled in a way by what he was facing. He'd never sort of experienced the kind of pressure both from someone he was competing with and from the coaches, and he needed an outlet, and she was there for it. But the psychologist, she was also sort of a fixer, too. If players had a problem with a legal issue and needed a lawyer or having a problem with their neighbor or with their girlfriend, we had a meeting at the beginning of training camp, and every team does this, and she said, "I'm the person to go to. I'll try to make things go away."
Do you think there's an ideal personality type to cope with the kind of pressure that the NFL puts on people?
I think it helps if you're supremely skilled at whatever you do in the NFL. I mean, that's a starting point. And that's a very few players who have that ability that exceeds by a factor of pick a number over the people that are competing or playing at the same position that they do. And for them, it's much easier, obviously. But players told me repeatedly that it's less a physical question in the NFL than it is a mental one. One guy said to me, you know, there are 100,000 guys that have the ability physically to play in the NFL that are good enough athletes to do it. But you see players come in every year who can't cope mentally. And I saw that happen. There was a quarterback with the Broncos named Bradley Van Pelt And Bradley was just struggled with his emotions. He didn't feel like he was getting the feedback. He was demoted in the on the depth chart, and every mistake he made in practice just snowballed until it actually buried him and kept him from performing his job well, and made his attitude deteriorate to the point that the coaches noticed, and he ended up getting cut.
It has to be really tough, Stefan, for all of these players, particularly the new rookies who are at camp for the first time. They've been a big star. Wherever they came from, whatever university, they were the cream of the crop there. And suddenly they're in this environment where they're not so special at all.
Yeah, it's a big hello. And the NFL doesn't do a lot to ease that transition. If a team has given a player a big bonus as a high draft pick, and we're talking about first or second round draft pick, then there's a little more patience. For everybody else, it's you know, everybody in the pool, and whoever comes out is the one that that makes the team. It is an amazing transition, and you see athletes, and they're experiencing this right now. I mean, I saw a lot of quiet kids, oddly enough, riding the shuttle bus from the hotel to the Broncos training facility in the morning, sitting in front of their lockers, looking contemplative. There's not a lot of joking around with the younger guys until they feel comfortable there, because they recognize that, whoa, everything is faster. Everything moves at a pace that some players described as, you know, double what they experienced in college. And that was really surprising to me when you realize the gap between how good the NFL is and how good college players are. It's really head-shaking. The players told me time and again that, you know, the complexity, the speed, the violence, the physicality of the NFL is so far ahead of even the best college programs that it takes them a long time to adjust. And that's often why you don't see rookies excel in football the way you might in other sports.
Where's the line between a healthy amount of confidence in a player on a team in the NFL and a detrimental amount of ego?
I didn't see a tremendous amount of ego, but the line is there, and these guys get humbled pretty quickly. You know, just as I experienced one mistake, one or two bad field goals in my debut as an on-field kicker with the Broncos, these guys go through the same thing. It's hard not to be humbled when you're in any profession, I think, when you're suddenly thrust onto a playing field or a performance space with the very best in the business. And these players, these athletes, pick up on that very quickly. I mean, athletes are nothing if not remarkably intuitive. They're very good at decoding what's going on around them, especially in football, you know, our most complex game, where so much is going on the field at any given time, that in order to succeed, you have to become a master strategist as much as anything else, that you have to react instantaneously and constantly. And the players that recognize that have that sort of intuitive ability to suss out what's going on around them, both on the field and just in their new environment, those are the ones that end up lasting a little bit longer, I think. And that doesn't necessarily mean they last for 10 years in the NFL, because careers are a lot shorter than that.
Stefan Fatsis is my guest. His book is called A Few Seconds of Panic, a 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. There's a great scene in the book where you're watching them play. I guess you were watching on TV, and you see them pull out something from the playbook that had hardly even been practiced, and you recognize it because you've been there. Can you talk about what they do to memorize all these plays and how complicated they really are?
They're amazingly complicated, and what they do is what good students do, or what I did when I became a good Scrabble player. I studied, and they study. They go back to their hotel rooms and they study. And not only do they study all the plays, but they're tested on the plays, you know, much like a student is. Before every game, the position coach will walk around the locker room and hand out a 2 or 3 or 4 page worksheet to every player in his group, and they have to fill it out, and they have to get it right. And one day before the first preseason game, I was sitting in the locker room watching a rookie fill it out, and a veteran player, this is a fullback named, that I mentioned, Kyle Johnson, he said to the kid, "No, that thing is hard, and I would not do that on my own the first time." And then we started talking about the complexity of plays and how how fans don't necessarily understand just how difficult it is to process all this information. And I said, well, why don't you just break down one play for me? And he opened up his playbook, and he found a play, and we went through it. And in the book, it takes up about three-quarters of a page just explaining what each piece of information contained in the code for the play signifies. And he was showing me on paper where everyone's supposed to go and what they're supposed to do and how responsibilities change given several variables that are contained on the play. That was fascinating to me, just to isolate that one little tiny piece of information. This is one out of several hundred plays that every player has to memorize, and you realize that you can't be a dummy to play this sport. This isn't guys just running around banging heads. This requires an enormous amount of brain power.
It's not just guys banging heads, but they do that a lot. It sounds like everybody is in constant pain.
They are. They don't talk about it often, but they are. You're never fully well in the NFL, and that's a given. Nobody complains about that. And the code of the locker room typically is, if it doesn't hurt enough to impede me from playing, then I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to go to the training room and get help for it. And there are a couple reasons. One is that if you have to go to the training room, you'll have to go in at 6:30 in the morning instead of 7:30. And that extra hour of sleep for many players is cherished. So they don't want to have to subject themselves to that. But beyond that, it was much more perceptual. And this really surprised me. A player said to me, you know, it's harder to overcome the perception of the coaches that you're hurt than it is the actual injury. So I know. And this was a guy that had been in the league for 4 or 5 years, a wide receiver named Charlie Adams. And Charlie said to me, I know how to play while I'm hurt. So I know I don't have to run as fast as I can on every play. I know how to compensate for my injuries. And that's what players will do.
That's a skill too, I guess.
It is.
Stefan Fatsis is my guest. His book is called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. If you've got a question for Stefan, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here this hour with Stefan Fatsis. His new book is called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. We have an email, Stefan, from Dan, who asks about the role that legal and illegal drugs play in sports therapy when people are injured.
Well, I saw no evidence of illegal drugs being used by the team doctors or the trainers. I wasn't inside the training room. It would not have surprised me at all to learn after the fact that some players had taken steroids. In fact, one player that was on the Broncos when I was there wound up testing positive the following season for violating the NFL steroids policy. And it's not a subject that gets talked about a lot in the locker room, at least not in casual conversation. The players I hung out with and the players that confided in me sort of one after another said, you know, I'm not going to do it. I'm not that stupid. I don't want to run the risk of losing my paycheck and ending my career. The anti-inflammatory of choice, however, with many of the Broncos seemed to be Vioxx, which had already been taken off the market. And players just said, a couple offensive linemen said to me, that stuff just works better than anything else. So despite the health risks that had been associated with it, they kept taking it after it had been pulled from the market.
So do they just have these jumbo supplies in storage?
You know, I don't know what they've got in the back room, but they have their medical doctors associated with every professional sports team, and they have the ability to write prescriptions. So if players were having symptoms of whatever malady and that required a prescription, they'd go into the back room with the trainer and the physician, and he could write a prescription and serve it right there.
having seen the pressure these guys are under to be in top physical condition, to be, in most cases, big and very strong, and not be injured, did you get a different perspective on the temptation to use steroids?
I didn't see it. I honestly came away feeling the opposite. I came away feeling that players know that their opportunity to excel in this sport is very, very brief. And anything that might compromise that is a risk. And you could argue that taking performance-enhancing drugs might be a benefit. But I think a lot of players are like most people. They have a sense of fallibility and of humanity, and they're not going to do anything that would jeopardize their chances of staying in this league and having the crack at the multi-million-dollar contract, the payday that is really the province of very few players in the NFL. I walked away thinking, yeah, probably a few guys at some point in their careers, like many, many players in the NFL, were tempted to and maybe did use illegal performance-enhancing drugs. But, you know, I also saw a lot of athletes who just like playing. And ultimately, that's why I think football players continue to play. The money is there for a few, but the competition is there for everybody. And I think that's just the nature of sports. And this is what these supremely gifted athletes have been trained to do their whole lives, and in many cases they're not trained to do anything else. So I think that, the drive of competition and the thrill of running out there on Sundays, is what propels them.
So they're all in the same uniforms, but every team in the NFL has a couple of these multi-million dollar players who are household words, and then a whole lot of guys who are making the league minimum or somewhere above that. Does that affect relationships on the team? Does it cause cliques to form at the top and the bottom levels of what people are paid and how well they're known?
I didn't see cliques form along those lines. I saw cliques form much more according to position, more than race, more than background, more than anything else. You know, the defensive guys hung out with the defensive guys. The quarterbacks hung out with the quarterbacks and the tight ends and the running backs. The money is conscious, but it's also sort of a taboo subject. The only time I saw it sort of openly discussed was there was a player that summer who was holding out, and the other players taped up a sort of running tally of how much money he owed in fines by sitting out of training camp. So it didn't endear him to the rest of the team, and he ended up getting traded. But, yeah, it's sort of another sort of quiet subject that you don't hear much about, similar to race in pro sports. You know, I like to think of pro sports, after being inside them for a little while, as almost post-race. Again, it's not the determiner in terms of who you hang out with or how you view your teammates.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Megan in Denton. Hi, Megan.
Hi. I just wanted to respond to something your guest said before the commercial, and that was you can't play the game and be stupid. I'm not a sports fan. I hate football. When athletes open their mouths and talk, I change the channel. But, you know, you've done a great job making it very interesting. It kind of transcends the subject. But I just want to say that I realized you can't be stupid when I was working as a cashier at Lowe's, and this guy came through my line. He is, like, middle-aged. I can tell right away, he wasn't your average person. Other than his, you know, physical appearance, he just seemed like a person who saw the big picture and had a lot of drive and intelligence and wasn't somebody that could be put off easily. And I think I asked him if he was a football player or something, because now he's a contractor in construction. And he said, yeah, I used to play for the Cowboys. And, I was just really impressed with him as a person. And I don't think that you can make it that far unless you have something that sets you apart. So that's it.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think fans, and it's not a universal. I mean, every player in the NFL isn't going to be brilliant and isn't going to be brilliantly successful in business. It doesn't necessarily have the common sense to succeed in life. But in order to succeed in the sport, you have to be built a certain way. And I don't mean physically. I mean your brain has to be built a certain way. Just as you have to be built a certain way to be a great violinist or a great swimmer like Michael Phelps or a great Scrabble player. It's everyone has unique talents, and with athletes and experts of any kind, it's years and years of obsessive preparation that allow those talents to be unleashed.
outside of what they have to do for their jobs, how much do they talk about sports among themselves?
They're fans. Professional athletes love watching sports. They don't live and die with sports the way that fans and the media do. And that was if not a gigantic revelation, it was a confirmation for me of the realities of our professional games, which is that the pressures of playing pro sports are so great that players can't dwell too long on what's happened in a particular game because they've got to think about the next game or the next play even. And it's really fans and the media that end up sort of dying a thousand deaths with every blown touchdown or lost game. The players have to move on because otherwise they couldn't function. They have to find a way to prepare for the next game and forget about the previous game. So the wins and losses end up, they matter because everybody wants to win, but they're not the end of the world. You know, Jake Plummer was the quarterback of the Broncos when I was there, and the season before I arrived in 2005, the Broncos made it to the AFC Championship game where they lost. And in the media the next day and on the chat boards and among fans, Plummer was reviled. You know, he choked, terrible, worst quarterback ever, loneliest guy in Colorado. He'll never be John Elway, the great quarterback. And Jake said to me one day, he said, in every game that you play, there's going to be a loser and there's going to be a winner. And that day we happened to be the losers. We didn't want to be, but it turned out that way. Things that we did all year long that worked didn't work that day. But that's what happened, and now I've got to move on and prepare for the next season, the next game.
An email from Sean in Louisville says, movies often portray football with a lot of players intentionally hurting other players, even to the degree of taking them out for an entire season. Is this a real circumstance in the NFL?
At the bottom of the pile, an offensive lineman said to me, things happen that you don't want to happen to you ever. But that's part of the competitive nature of the game. And look, they're going to be idiot players who have sort of a testosterone overload, or don't know how to control their physical behaviors on the field and do deliberately try to injure. I don't think it's that frequent. These guys are technicians. Players know exactly what they can do to hurt themselves and what they also can do to try to protect themselves. And watch when a player goes down and is motionless. We saw a Buffalo Bills player last year get carried off and was temporarily and then paralyzed and made a remarkable recovery. But watch how silent it gets on the field. There's no intent to harm deliberately 99% of the time, I would say. And players want to avoid it because they know. They read the stories about the long-term effects of playing football, the depression, early onset Alzheimer's, the hip replacements and knee replacements. They know all about that, and it's hard for them to discuss it because it's so painful to think about what their lives could be like when they're in their 40s and 50s. So there is a consciousness when you're on the field that you don't want to take someone's life away or his livelihood away.
Do they tend to sort of personalize it if they happen to be involved physically in someone else getting hurt accidentally?
I didn't hear much discussion about that. I think it's accepted as part of the game, and that sounds like a cliche because it is, but it's probably also something of a defense mechanism. I mean, every player knows that whenever he sets foot on the field, that he could be responsible for someone else getting injured pretty badly. And I think that's too great a responsibility to bear on a daily basis. So I think players just say, hey, that's part of the game, and you hope it doesn't happen to me, and I hope it doesn't happen to the guy that I happen to hit.
I guess that you're not writing about sports in quite the same way as you were when you had a daily deadline for the Wall Street Journal, but do you think the way you cover football is now forever changed?
Well, I never covered football in the way that most football writers cover football. I've never covered a team. I've never written a game story. I've never had to write a profile on deadline about some guy based on quotations that I've assembled during the day or in the locker room. So my perspective's always been a little bit different, and I'd like to think that I brought a more nuanced approach toward covering. Toward writing about this game, and that was my goal in this book. You know, we tend to view NFL players as commodities, whether it's as part of our fantasy football teams, or a name on the back of a jersey that we might buy in a store. I wanted to humanize the players and understand with a greater breadth what they do for a living and what they go through.
So we hear you all the time on All Things Considered, but you have never been interviewed by Melissa Block, who is your wife. Is it just too weird?
Yeah, just too weird. We kind of made a decision a long, long time ago that we wouldn't talk to each other on the air because it would be sort of deceptive to listeners who don't know our relationship, and sort of journalistically a little awkward. So I only talk to Robert Siegel and Michelle North.
So is that why you're only there some Fridays?
That's when my wife is hosting a show on by herself. I will not be on the air, which happened last Friday. Yes, now we're giving away our public radio secrets here.
Oh, no. There's not that many to give away, so we might as well thrill people a little bit. Let me ask you this. You have said that you actually missed being there, that season in 2006 when the team was actually out there and playing. You were sad to see them playing their first real game and you were home.
I was. I'm just human. You know, when you're locked up with a bunch of people for an extended period of time, when you walk away, you still want to be with them, assuming that you're in a place that's relatively pleasant and doing things that are relatively fun. And there is a privilege to being involved with a professional sports team. And, you know, I didn't see a lot of examples of the players wielding that privilege, being haughty or arrogant or pompous in the community or even in the locker room. But when you're in that world, you kind of want to stay in that world. And, you know, it was just a lot of fun to be able to run out there in, you know, official NFL gear and kick footballs on this beautiful NFL field. It really was a gift for me. And again, not because I had some burning desire to hang around with NFL superstars. For me, it was just an experience of being in this different world and being allowed to translate what happens in that world for the public.
Are you still at 172, or have you gotten back down to your soccer weight?
I've actually, unlike most NFL players, unlike many NFL players, I've lost the weight that I put on to play in the league. Yeah, so I did go kicking a few weeks ago, and I managed to make a 35-yarder, so that was pretty good.
When you go kicking, if it's just you and you're out there, do you have to have someone go fetch the ball for you, or is that part of the workout that you're running after it each time?
Well, if I'm with my coach, we have lots of football, so you don't have to, like, chase one down and bring it back.
Does one leg get much bigger than the other?
No, because you're lifting with both legs. One leg ends up being sore in different ways than the other. It's funny, I was back in Denver last week at training camp, and was talking to one of the kickers, and the kickers that I hung out with and that were there when I was there are long gone now, including the veteran Jason Elam, who's now with the Atlanta Falcons. But we were just talking about kickers, and sort of the injuries came up, and it was like, well, those are the two injuries I had. I had a strained right groin and a sore left hip flexor, and I had to treat them just like you guys treat them. So it did bring me back on that regard. And even after I had kicked a few weeks ago, and I did it as part of an interview with Scott Simon on Weekend Edition at NPR, and I was sore for the next 5 days.
So the groin strain is part of the rite of passage.
Part of the payment for being an NFL player.
The book by Stefan Fatsis is called A Few Seconds of Panic. Stefan, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.